This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Fiona Helmsley, whose new essay collection is Girls Gone Old, which came out in August from We Heard You Like Books. Fiona Helmsley's writing can be found in various anthologies like Ladyland and The Best Sex Writing of the Year, and online at websites like The Weaklings, The Hairpin, Pank, and The Rumpus. A multiple pushcart nominee, her book of essays and stories, My Body Would Be the Kindest of Strangers, was released in 2015. And her latest book is Girls Gone Old. Here's the publisher's book jacket summary. 2016 was a pivotal year for Fiona Helmsley, and on the eve of her 40th birthday, an old friend questioned the subject matter of her writing. Why so often did Fiona reflect back on the questionable choices she made when she was younger? Wasn't 40 a good age to grow up and move on to more mature subject matter? A few months after her friend's question, a much more monumental, catastrophic event occurred. Professional ignoramus Donald J. Trump was elected president. The 80s, the decade Fiona had grown up in, had ascended to the Oval Office big time. In Girls Gone Old, Fiona Helmsley doesn't answer her friend's question so much as she subverts it. With new essays about the confluence of 80s television art and sexual fantasy, addiction and illness, school shootings and serial killers, family, Andy Warhol, and the sleazy yet sexy misogyny of Axl Rose, Girls Gone Old rebukes the notion of the self as a lesser muse. I'll just repeat that that was a quote from the book. The publisher's summary of the book, Girls Gone Old. I spoke to Fiona Helmsley last week and began by asking her about the opening essay in the collection, My Icon Hates Me. In the essay, Helmsley never names the icon, but instead always substitutes name redacted. I asked if she had done this to seriously protect the icon or if she was trying to be funny, because name redacted is used so many times, it started to strike me that perhaps it was supposed to be something of a punchline, and perhaps this icon would not want her name redacted. Was Fiona Helmsley punishing her? Turns out not. But anyway, Fiona's full answer is interesting, and it begins our conversation. I hope you enjoy listening.
Well, she, as a person, she seems to kind of revel in her bad behavior.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. So maybe she wouldn't have minded. But
yeah.
I'm sure that the way that she would describe our interactions would probably be different. I didn't want to give her a fake name because I think to some people it's pretty obvious who it is.
Yeah.
So I went with name redacted.
No, okay. So that wasn't even meant to be funny. It was just me reacting to it as funny.
No, but that's great. The essay is supposed to be funny. I mean, it's hoping to be funny.
It
but
is.
But I mentioned in there that I do a website, which is pictures of writers' sweaters.
Yeah.
But in real life, I do a website that's pictures of writers' shoes.
Okay.
So, you know, everything was changed a little bit for, you know, humorous effect.
Yeah. And what about... Oh, sorry. What about identifying other people? Were other people's names changed in the collection for the most part?
Oh, totally throughout.
Yeah.
I can't think of where they weren't.
Yeah.
I'm always really good about that.
It's fun, though, because in reading it, it's like, wow, this person, Pam Hackett. Oh, not Pam Hackett, but you have a friend that you write about later in the collection. Anyway, it was just like you come up with names, and I'm like, wow, that's such a specific name. I wonder if that's the person's name. So.
Right, no, it definitely changed. And I was thinking I should probably, I do, in other essays that I've written, I use like a lot of like Fred's, Tom, like Mary. I was thinking maybe I should amp that up a bit and get a little bit more
give them
with the names.
Yeah, give them. Yeah, okay. So your title, Girls Gone Old, is playing with the title of the 90s reality show and entertainment franchise, Girls Gone Wild. And
yes.
And then at one point in the collection, you write about being referred to as the aunt of a younger man you used to date, which turns out
right.
to have been his way of calling you old.
Right.
And then you write about your feelings around this and around aging and also being told to grow up and move on to more mature subject matter in your writing. So I wondered, what do you want to say to women as they age? What is your takeaway?
Well, I have to say, as somebody who I was raised in a feminist household, I never had Barbie dolls. My mother took us to the Seneca Peace Camp in when I was in the 80s, which was this big you know, feminist gathering to protest a like nuclear power plant. I am having a really hard time with getting older. And it embarrasses me as somebody who has like all these feminist references. And, you know, read so many feminist thinkers.
Right.
I'm definitely having a hard time with it. And I haven't experienced that. I mean, I'm 41.
Right.
And I haven't, I don't, you know, there's a, still a lot more to go. But I'm having a really hard time with it. And some of it is, as I write in the essay, the change in the way that I am perceived by other people.
Right.
Like yesterday, I work at a library, and we have a very young, there's a very young person who works there, a male who's very suave. I can tell he's very confident. I can tell probably young girls in his age group love him. But the way that he'll talk to me, he'll say these little things. Like he was talking about they're having a problem with field day at the school. They want to change some things about it.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with field day, what field day is?
Well, is it like a lot of sports outside? Everybody
Right. It's like a school spirit thing.
Right, right.
So he's telling me about all the changes that they're being made. And then he says all of a sudden, you know, maybe you don't know what that is. Maybe they didn't have that when you were a kid. And I mean, that's something so small, but you know, just things like that, and the change in the way that I see them.
Do you get called ma'am?
Yes.
Yeah.
I get ma'am fairly often, but every once in a while, I'll still get carded for cigarettes. There's that real conflict, though. Like I know that it shouldn't make any difference, but I guess for so long, I've been such a. I think all women are, to a certain extent, probably more people are probably maybe able to navigate it better, but it's just the change is hard.
It is, yeah. It's. I remember my first ma'am. I was a waitress, and I was in my 20s, and somebody called me ma'am. I'm like, what, are you kidding me? I'm in my 20s.
Right.
And I think the other thing that happens is, and you do write about having a son, you know, you have kids, and then all of a sudden, that whole generation just, like, makes you feel just ancient, and they revel in making you feel ancient.
Yeah.
So.
Definitely. Oh, my son is huge on making old jokes. And,
yeah.
You know, it's, I really want him and I to have a good relationship, and I really want us to be, like, open and be able to talk about things, but I guess, to a certain extent, you know, kids are always just resistant to that, so.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We'll see.
And then, so I'm older than you, I'm in my mid-50s, and, you know, in circles now, I'll be in a circle where women are talking about, you know, how horrible and heinous it is that there's Botox and plastic surgery, and that this is what so many women are deciding that their future holds. And then I'll be in other circles where people are sort of like, do you know where I can get good Botox around here? You know, and it's just like, it is very strange. It's very strange to sort of want to recreate yourself as you age.
Right. Right. And it's, for me, it's a huge conflict. I don't want to play into that. I'm very aware of, you know, those beauty standards and what they do to women and how unrealistic and how unfair and how they have nothing to do with your value. But still, I guess some part of me wants to be thought of, you know, as desire. It's for men, you know, and also, you know, you want to look in the mirror and feel good about yourself.
Right.
So I really feel, I haven't done any of that yet, but yes, I've investigated it. And I support people who do that. I have friends who do that. I mean, you want to feel good about yourself.
Right.
But there's something very sinister about it.
Yeah.
You know? And you're shooting botulism into your body.
Do you mind if I just read a little quote from the book and then we can talk about it?
Sure.
This is relevant to what we're talking about. So you write, I've learned that women can use their physicality, but they will never be able to control what happens once they do. And that section actually goes on to a funny statement about how hard it is, having turned men on, to get them to focus and to get them to read, that made me laugh. But that quote interests me. And you know what? This isn't even the question I was going to ask you, though. Hold on. I'm sorry. I do want to ask you this question, but I wanted to ask another one while we're talking about this. So later you write about how, having used your physicality in the way you did, The concept of old now carries more sting. And you write, maybe if I hadn't defaulted to it, old wouldn't make me feel like someone was trying to take something from me. And that really did ring a bell. On the other hand, I felt like
We are told all our lives that it's our physicality that matters, whether or not we choose to use it.
Right.
And so I think the sting would still be there, but I'm curious what you think about that.
As you navigate the world, you see how important it is and how much of a difference it does make, whether you think it's BS, whether you think it's sad and sinister, but it does make a difference. And at the same time, you're also told, you know, that more people who are highly evolved, it's about what's inside that counts, this and that. And it would be great to get to that place where I could, because that's the way I interact with people. That's what I think is important.
Right.
You know, what they bring to the table. I've never been look-centric in who I date or who I'm friends with. But, I mean, society bombards you with that message. You know, whether you want to participate or not, you face the consequences of it. I was thinking the other day, it was something that I had started to write about, like, when I was a young girl. And I really believed that I could do anything. I really believed that, you know, I could go out in the world and people would accept me and, you know, I would be treated like I had value. And then there was this one point in gym class where it was my first ugly. That's what I started to call it in the essay. This boy said that I was ugly, and he said it viciously, and he said it as if my value decreased, as if I was, because I was ugly, I was cut off from something.
Right.
And it really had a big effect on me. You know, I could see it looking back, like that was kind of the switch. You know, I had so much self-esteem and belief in myself, but then there was something, you know, it was my body. How could I change that?
Right.
You know, I was ugly. You know, and it was something people would hold against me.
Yeah, it reminds me of how Karen Carpenter was written about as being right. The chubby sister, and that really was what created her whole self-perception. And it's so.
I mean, you would like to think it doesn't have the weight that it does. But it absolutely does. I mean, beauty is so celebrated. I mean, that's a duh statement. But the most famous family of women in the country, you know, and I do think the Kardashians are talented. I mean, people say they're not talented. I think that they are. They're very talented at what they do. They're very talented at keeping people interested.
Yeah.
But it's also very much propped up and on the beauty standard. For me, that's been it continues to be a huge conflict, and it's so embarrassing to me because it's so superficial and so ridiculous, and it doesn't last. I mean, you do get older, beauty fades, but you know, it's very damaging to women. It's like we live under that. And I write in the book about talking to my grandmother.
Yeah,
It's in the section, the little flash fiction.
Yes.
Section, and she says, oh, she's changing in front of, she had this big picture window.
Right.
Taking her clothes off, and she had a home health aide at the time who said to her, you know, Miss Rita, don't do that. People will see you. And she said, you know, to the home health aide, they stopped wanting to look a long time ago. Let me enjoy my freedom.
Exactly,
I guess
yeah.
For me, I'm trying to get to that place.
Right.
And it's embarrassing to me that so much of my life was built around in the trajectory. A lot of it stemmed from that guy in gym class that first day calling me ugly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then there were uglies after that. You know. So
yeah. But you know what? I think that it's interesting that you talk about being embarrassed, because I suppose within our own self-image, we can be embarrassed by the thoughts we have. But the fact that you write about this stuff puts it out there, and so it's something that you have to sort of like own publicly. But by putting it out there, you lessen whatever embarrassment the rest of us might have about these thoughts that we aren't writing about. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I know that other people feel the same way.
Yeah.
You know, I have friends who, I mean, they don't talk about it so much now that they're older, but I remember when we were younger, you know, I mean, it's something I'm still in the process of trying to work through. I write in the book a little bit about the sex industry, and I've said in other essays that I've written, I it's so sad for me to say this, but part of me wanted to see if men would be willing to pay for my companionship.
Yeah.
You know, was I desirable enough for that. So
yeah.
it's very sad, the weight that and the life it can take people to.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I want to just back up 1 second here and talk about the question I started with, and then I realized I was in the wrong place. So you do say, I've learned that women can use their physicality, but they will never be able to control what happens once they do. And I wonder if we can talk about that. Did you specifically mean being overpowered physically, or were you talking about other reasons?
I mean, it kind of never stops.
Yeah.
Like the Kardashians, the backbone of their empire is built on these beautiful women.
Right.
You know, Kim will she admits to it. I mean, as soon as she has a baby, you know, she's immediately trying to lose the weight again so she can get back into her skinny jeans and start taking selfies. I don't think there's ever any peak with that. Once you stop, the whatever it's gotten you will lessen. I remember I saw this video. I talked about this in another interview with Paris Hilton.
Uh-huh.
And she was in a bathtub with Joe Francis, the gross man who started Girls Gone Wild. And this was the height of Paris's fame. She was the most famous woman in the world, so wealthy. And you would think that circumstances would change for her. But in this video, Joe Francis is totally pawing the most famous woman in the world, totally sexually harassing her, degrading her. And here she is, the most famous, you know, a wealthy woman in the world, and she's sitting there and she's putting up with it. It doesn't. I don't know. I don't know. I guess what it gets you when you travel down that path isn't anything of much value unless you move it into something else. I guess you start selling perfume.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, you know. Yeah, I mean, the nature of aging is that if you have made your reputation on your physicality in one way or another, that eventually is going to change.
Right.
Yeah. Did you, this is a little bit of a tangent, did you see the thing the librarians did since your work in the library?
So.
It was so funny. Anyway, the Kardashians have, like, I think they have a new book out, and the cover is very provocative, all of them together, and a group of librarians imitated it. It was very funny. You can look it up. Anyway, sorry.
I would like to see it.
Can we talk a little bit about the Me Too campaign on social media? Were you aware of all of that last week?
I was. I'm like in the midst of a social media blackout. I have to go back on soon because I have a story that's coming out. I don't like the internet very much.
No.
At one time I used to really enjoy it. But especially when I have something to promote, I don't like it very much.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like I'm performing to a certain extent.
Yeah.
It was started by Alyssa Milano. I've never been one that's had a hard time with any kind of acceptance to the fact that more people have experiences with sexual assault and sexual harassment than don't. I worked at a women's halfway house, and one night we would have dinner together. One night at the dinner table, everybody sitting around me had been sexually assaulted. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
By, you know, the number of women who are using that hashtag. I mean, it's so ingrained in our society. Now I'm talking about sexual harassment a little
right.
bit.
Right, yeah.
Men think of women as a reward system. They think, when especially men in positions of power, they think of women as, like, accessories of that power. You know, demonstrative examples. Donald Trump is the perfect example.
Yes.
Right? Buying Miss America, buying a whole harem a beautiful woman because he was rich and he could. So, I don't know. And now I guess men are responding too. They have some hashtag about how I'll be different.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it's so widespread. It's the language of the way men talk to each other when they're alone.
Right. Right. Well, and Donald Trump, you know, Donald Trump being caught on video talking about grabbing women is a perfect example.
Right. It didn't make a difference.
No.
It didn't make a difference.
It's so, I mean, I'm still surprised by that. That didn't make a difference.
Right. And the thing that I think all of this requires, men, and I mean good men, too. I mean, men who, for the most part, in their interactions with women are actually respectful. It requires men to accept that they've done it, too, because it's the same thing. Just more women have been sexually assaulted than haven't been. More men have sexually harassed and treated women, you know, in a degrading way than haven't.
Yeah.
It's just the way that it is. I was looking at my son's phone. He's 12. And him and his friends do this thing where they text song lyrics back and forth.
Yeah.
And they were song lyrics. But I was thinking to myself, if this wasn't, you know, my 12-year-old child is, you know, being a creeper. It's so pervasive. I mean, it's just the language of how men talk to each other and this idea of women as, like, this reward system.
Yeah, I have this I have this group of friends from college, and we stay in touch pretty much every day using WhatsApp, just sort of a ongoing conversation all the time. And we were kind of coming to this epiphany yesterday that all the songs we loved in college, all the songs we loved were about men getting laid. Yeah. They were all about men getting laid. There, you know, it was Brick House. It was Sexual Healing. It was, you know, just like song after song after song. And so few of them were about what women were looking for, whether it be sexual or something else. And it was just like, wow.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, even, you know, you walk down the street and, you know, there's a chorus of, or I mean, I don't know now. I live in the woods in Connecticut now. But when I lived in New York, and I write about in the essay how I was damaged to the point where I would seek that out. But I mean, it's so casual that men scream at women as they walk down the street.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be something that's so hard to change. And I mean, the Harvey Weinstein, you know, what he had done, I mean, there were years of lawsuits. It was just the New York Times being able to, you know, get enough evidence together to print about it, and people had tried to write about it for years.
Yeah.
So it's interesting what stories actually, you know, make it. And usually it takes something like, you know, Miramax was going to lose an incredible amount of money, and that's finally why they cut him loose.
Yeah.
So it's crazy, but it's so entrenched.
Yeah.
That you know, and I don't have much faith in hashtag campaigns changing much of anything. The nature of hashtag campaigns is that they trend. I mean, a trend ends.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and people only pay attention to the trend that they're particularly interested in, too. I mean, it's
right.
Kind of, yeah.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. This is an interview with the author Fiona Helmsley. If you're enjoying the show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. I should mention that the views expressed on Write the Book are solely those of the speakers. Stay tuned for the rest of the interview. I hope you're enjoying.
Let's see. I wanted to, this is a different topic, but you write this thing about on reading, and I really liked it. You write, "I don't trust people when it comes to what they read. I work with books and know that most people don't take many risks. When it comes to books, most people either, one, read what their friends read, two, heed the advice of disembodied strangers who sometimes have vested interest in what they are hyping so glowingly online and in newspapers, magazines, three, equate the quality of the writing with the amount of money it's made for the author. Author, publisher." So this made me wonder how you find your books and how people can navigate the thousands of books that are so regularly released now through all the different publishing venues. And do you read self-published works? That's another part of that question.
I do. If I have an interest or I've read other things by the writer. But I have to say, when my book came out, I've written a lot for the web.
Yeah.
I've written all over the place.
Right.
I was really surprised to see that so many of the websites that I wrote for didn't cover my book, especially when they'd had essays from the book up on the site.
Wow.
And, you know, we had the publicist sent out the books to them. And, you know, it was kind of really, I was really insulted. And I was just trying to figure out, like why, what, then, and I didn't ask because I could never ask, you know, that would be crass. I was thinking about writing an essay about it. And what determines what they choose to cover. I mean, you know, there's always that hot book, and I'm mostly talking about the small press because that's where I come from.
Right.
There's usually that hot book that they all then cover with a review that's similar to the first review. So I don't know. Books can also be accessories. you know, people want to be associated with, you know, certain ideologies.
Yeah.
You know, I love Maggie Nelson.
Yes.
And her book, The Argonauts, was great, but she became one of those writers who was, and I used a quote from her in my last book. I mean, this isn't anything against her work at all, but, you know, there become these, like, certain cool writers, and everybody, you know, pays attention to them, and, you know, the person who's doing the review gets some cool points. I'm just not a cool writer.
I think you're a pretty cool writer, even if you haven't been discovered as such on a larger basis.
With this book, I mean, we had a publicist who was great. For the first month, it seemed like it was doing really well. I did this interview on Salon.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw anything.
I saw that.
And I got killed by the alt-right afterward.
Oh.
I could not believe it, because I also said in the interview, you know, I said some things that are sort of in line with, I guess, what their platforms are, or whatever they give lip service to. I said some things about, like, having to buy into the middle class.
Yeah.
And I said a few things about trigger warnings, but they really focused. I absolutely stand by what I say. I had said something about, male entitlement and, you know, how when men get angry, and I was talking, and I meant in reference to school shootings,
Charlottesville,
and, even terrorist attacks, you know, the men tend to lash out. There's this sense of entitlement. You know, women tend to go in, we hurt ourselves. But men are much more likely to lash out. And they just, I mean, they kind of backed up my point.
Yeah.
They were angry at what I said, and they lashed out.
Yeah.
You know, I was talked about on this Glenn Beck program. Somebody set up a fake Facebook page in my name. Yeah. I mean, there was some question as to whether or not I should respond to it, you know, promotion-wise. But it was just, I mean, people didn't translate to any book sales being, you know, talked about all over the place on these crazy websites.
Right. Yeah, no, I have a question about that, actually. So you sort of talked about men's fragility sparking their anger and their fears of being replaced. You know, they were chanting, you know, I don't know, we won't be replaced or something like that. So I did have a question about whether you hear from people after speaking out about them and if you got a lot of negative reaction online. So where will you hear that stuff mostly? Is it just like...
Oh, my God. I usually use a Yahoo email.
Yeah.
People figured out what my Gmail email was, which would be easy to figure out. I got a ton of emails there. There's this bizarre woman who I guess monitors, like, all the Salon interviews. And she sent me this bizarre email, like, lecturing me about, like, how men are treated badly in divorce proceedings. I mean, it was just, it was crazy. Kelly was there. There were discussion threads online.
Yeah.
You know, and on Twitter.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, and to go back to what we were originally talking about, and in the comments, they're talking about, you know, that I'm unattractive. You know, like I'm a frigid feminist. You know, I mean, the reason why I didn't do an essay to respond to them was because you can't. It's you know, part of, and this is Trump too. Part of what we've elected a troll,
yeah,
who's backed by an army of trolls.
Yeah.
You can't, on the internet, it's like which is funny because, you know, you can't hear the other person. But on the internet, it's like who screams the loudest, who, you know, degrades the best. And to try to engage them in any way would just be asking for more ridiculousness.
Yeah. Now, Talking about the internet, you have an essay in the collection called 2002, An Internet Odyssey, and that begins, how should a person be, well, the section that I'm going to talk about begins, how should a person be on the internet? And you write, in 2002, my answer to this question would have been a lot like Courtney Love on the internet. But so how about now? How should a person be on the internet now, in your opinion?
Oh, God. I mean, I think in the early days of the internet, we didn't really know what it was.
Right.
We didn't really know how it could launch careers, how it could, you know, that you could attract all these people and then somehow, you know, turn that into a platform. I mean, I, as you can see in that essay, I used to be very free on the internet, and I don't think that was right either. I mean, looking back now, I mean, it was quite embarrassing.
But you write beautifully about that, about the person you are now, looking back on the person you were then and feeling for her. Sorry.
No, it's quite hard for me to read, to look at that journal. I don't know. I have to take breaks from it. I mean, I have New York Times app on my phone. I use it for news and for email. But the social networking stuff, I don't, especially since I've been doing more with my writing, and I've been publishing more.
Yeah.
And I know the goal is to get people to read these things and to set up an audience for my work. I could feel myself, I felt constrained. I was beginning to feel constrained, especially on sites like Facebook where I would be friends with editors. I felt like I couldn't necessarily be myself. And I would see reactions sometimes where what I was. There was a writer that I looked up to. If I'm going to be on social networking, I want to have fun.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be goofy. And in the writing community can be a bit snotty.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
More than a bit. And I just got a new iPhone, and I found that there was an app on it. That it was like a basal vaginal temperature app. I don't even know how it worked. It was pre-programmed on the phone. It was something to do with fertility. So I posted a picture of it. Like, I just found this basal vagina temperature app on my phone. And this writer and I had just connected on the site. Like, she finally accepted my friend request. So I just happened to be on her page, like, reading to see what, was going on over there. And later on, I checked her page again after I put up the basal
thing,
picture, and she deleted me.
Oh.
So I just don't. And I've had other editors who published my work later on delete me on Facebook, and it's like, I just try to have fun on it. I try to be funny sometimes, and I guess it just doesn't work. And I guess I don't want them to hold that against my writing.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of things.
One thing that occurred to me as I was reading the book was that it really, it accomplishes something as far as offering a history of how the internet created new social pressures and probably created even more anxiety and insecurity and sort of self-loathing in young people. I wondered if that was part of your goal in pointing that out.
No, but I absolutely acknowledge it. I'm so happy that I grew up before the internet.
Yeah, me too.
So happy. I mean, my social life was so important to me when I was a young person. So absolutely important. I had my own phone line, and I remember one day, like, the phone wasn't ringing for like an hour.
Yeah.
And then I noticed it was unplugged, and I remember like freaking out, like, "Oh my God, what did I miss?" but I know that if I had the internet in its capacities had existed when I was a child, I know that I would have done something incredibly embarrassing to get the attention of some young boy. I don't doubt it for a second, because I know what I did. the equal for that at that time period before there was the internet. It's all of those things. The selfies, which I think can also be art, but it reinforces, those ideas about beauty and beauty being rewarded for it, and that being important. I'm very grateful that I knew a world before. The internet leaves me with a lot of agita and conflicted feelings.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you mentioned already that you have an essay that's a collection of 12 flash fictions. I loved that section. They're just beautiful little stories of your life. One of them has to do with your mother's dream of owning an Irish castle. Another one has to do with a boyfriend that you had when you were 11 who really let you down. Another one has to do with, this was so sad, your family would run away when your dad was not home because you knew he was getting drunk and you needed to leave before he got back. And the race away from the house before dad got back was actually something that made your heart race, and it was sort of almost fun. Anyway, these 12 little pieces are just a wonderful snapshot of a whole life or a part of parts of your life. Do you want to talk a little bit about writing those and structuring them?
Well, it was originally up on a website called The Fanzine. Some of them had started as Facebook posts, and that could give you an idea of the kind of things that I was posting on Facebook.
Okay.
So they had started that way, and I restructured them a little bit. The one about my grandmother, she died about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, she'd been, you know, she's very sick towards the end, so I'd been posting on Facebook about, you know, my interactions with her then. So they were both mostly Facebook statuses that I, you know, altered in some way. I used to, because I started on the internet on LiveJournal, that was very much my posting style, and still tends to be.
Yeah.
And still tends to be. You know, I don't have a Twitter page. I don't think I could ever do Twitter anyway, because it's much too limiting. But maybe I should. You know, just do the cut and run of Twitter. So I tend to, you know, I tend to post that way, you know, like little essays. Yeah, they were just, there's one about my son's father.
Yeah. Yeah, is that the last one? There's one that was really interesting because it reads like, it refers to a conversation, but doesn't refer to the other participant. It's we. Everything is, you know, we have a conversation, but you don't tell us who the we is. I liked that.
Let me find my book. There it
is. Yeah, do you want to read that one?
Sure. We were talking about an essay I wrote about my son's father's death and how whenever he checked himself into treatment, he'd always dress to look his best. And we were talking about how, unless you come from money, by the time you're willing to check yourself in somewhere, there's usually not much wiggle room around it. You look as ruined as you feel. We talked nothing about why he always made the effort. And we talked about how I haven't been in treatment since 2004, but by that time I tried it close to 20 different times, and there was always someone there with me who had that red and black parka that you used to be able to get for free by redeeming Marlboro miles. I think that was a conversation that I was having with his sister.
Oh, yeah. And to some extent, it didn't matter who it was with, but I liked the not knowing and I liked the wondering. You know, I was like, is she having a conversation with her son? Is she having a conversation in a group therapy setting? Is it with a friend or somebody? I don't know. It didn't matter who it was, but I liked that it made me wonder.
Well, it's funny. I used to be a really big fan of Stephen Elliott.
Oh, yeah.
To Own the Rumpus.
Yeah, he's been on this show.
Oh, really? Oh, great.
Yeah.
But he used to do that in his daily... I don't know if I was necessarily inspired by that, but reading it now makes me think of him doing that. In his daily rumpus email,
yeah,
he used to do that. You know, we were never identifying the we, or, you know, he probably, there is that influence of him in that a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, since we're talking already about, that's sort of, I think, a bit of a craft subject, the craft of writing essay, and I would love to talk to you about your use of transition. There was one essay called The Rape Book, which just, it was so fantastic. It's a series of paragraphs that interweave thoughts and memories about a childhood friend that you're still in touch with and the notebook the two of you kept with the names of boys about whom you had rape fantasies. And then your thoughts about why rape fantasies exist. And then you interweave sections about Andy Warhol, who was known for exaggeration and hyperbole, and sections about what you watched on TV, like Mork and Mindy. And there's just so much going on in this essay, and I'm not trying to be comprehensive about it, but the braiding of all these strands is really fascinating. I liked just studying how you did it. And I wonder if you can talk about writing this piece and revising it into this shape and how you settle on transitions between sections.
Right. Well, Maggie Dowson, as I mentioned before,
right,
is a writer that I really like.
Yeah.
And she does that often with her work.
Yeah.
And I read a lot. I work at a library. My books are my life, especially now in my older age. I mean, that's what I spend most of my time doing. I get up 2 hours before I have to start my day just so I can read every day.
Yeah.
In the morning. That's my time. That's my favorite time. So definitely the structure of some of her writing influences that. Maybe Kate Zambrino to an extent, too. And I would like to do more with that. I am a fangirl. If anything, I am a huge fangirl, something I'm not embarrassed about. You know, if I admire somebody, I want to, especially before the internet, if I admired somebody, I would write them a letter, or I would seek them out. I would want to meet them.
Yeah, like with your icon.
Right, yeah. So I'm a huge Andy Warhol fan. Huge. I did a display at the library where I work of all my Andy Warhol related ephemera. When trying to write that essay, what started that was, and so many of the essays in the book are really what it comes down to is the theme is, I had this idea. It was wrong. This is why, or I'm trying to figure out why.
Right.
And with the rape book, I was trying to figure out why, and it's something, you know, probably a lot of people wouldn't read into. Oh, you know, you're using that word facetiously, or... But I had this notebook that a friend and I had started, and we called it the rape book, boys that we wanted to rape us. And, of course, what we meant was boys that we wanted to, like, acknowledge our existence, boys that we wanted, you know, attention from. But it intrigued me that I had called it that and that I could, that my first sexual fantasies all essentially involved, They were rape fantasies, but as I also say in the essay, I wasn't doing anything that I didn't want to do. It was to fantasize that way was to give myself permission.
Right.
Another thing that I think is so sad, you know, I just felt that there was something so wrong about me thinking about sex that I had to storyboard it in my mind that I was being forced to do it.
Yeah, because you're not supposed to. I mean, that's not something that young women were supposed to do or are supposed to do. Yeah.
Right. And I wanted to so bad. And these were my quiet, most innermost thoughts. Nobody would know that I was thinking these things. But still, in my quiet, most innermost alone thoughts, I had to tell it to myself that way, that Mickey Dolenz, you know, we were walking off in the sand consensually. It had to be that he was, you know, attacking me.
Right. And we have to remind people that he was the drummer in the Monkees, which just, I loved. I loved that he was the one.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, I've talked about this in another interview, but I ended up meeting him.
Oh, you did?
And it was, and it was right before the book came out. And I was thinking to myself, if I had had the book, would I have given it to him? And I probably would have. but it was interesting.
But you must have been, you're too young for the Monkees. So how did that happen?
That's what he said to me too. He was like, you're too young to have been a fan.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, I watched you on Nickelodeon. And he said, oh, the second wave. Like there's waves to Monkees fandoms. And you know, and then I knew Andy Warhol was somebody who also too, in so many of his interviews, he talks about being ugly. And he was a person who was really hard to pull, a lot of detail out of.
Yeah.
But going from interview to interview, I would find little, you know, things that he had said about, you know, he said he became an artist because he was ugly and there was nothing else for him to do.
Huh.
So I had posted onto Tumblr. I have a Tumblr page because all I, you know, really do is put up pictures. About how Bridget Berlin, who's a Warhol superstar, was selling, used to make paintings with her breasts, and they had a painting on eBay for like $2,000. And I said, somebody needs to buy me this. But instead, this person bought me a sweatshirt that says Warhol superstar. So I wanted to incorporate, I mean, so much has been written about Andy Warhol.
Yeah. I have this memory, had this experience in the 90s where I was walking down the street in New York with a friend, and I think my husband actually, and the street was just packed. It was one of those times where it's just like shoulder to shoulder with people, and I could see way up ahead that everybody who was traveling in the same direction I was started turning around, and as it came toward me, it was like this wave of people turning around coming toward me, and then all of a sudden Andy Warhol walked by, and I turned around too to watch him go by, and it was like the whole street just stopped and watched him walk by. I thought, it must be so weird to be that person, that icon.
Right, and he had looked up to, I mean, I love old film. That's one of my new obsessions now. Like, I'm obsessed with old film. Actually, I'm working on a story about, it's just this tiny little piece about Katharine Hepburn and Howard Hughes, something that I'm working on now. But he was somebody who was, you know, a kid in Pittsburgh who would go to the movies and see these very glamorous people, to people he saw as being very glamorous.
Yeah.
And they just totally influenced so much about what he thought of the world.
Yeah.
And in that essay, too, I don't go into it that deeply, but I got so many of my cues from television, which is the worst. you know, especially in the 80s, that was not the time to do it.
Yeah.
And it's so funny to me now because my mother and I are so close. We are so close. We could talk about anything. But when I was a kid, I felt like I couldn't talk to her. I don't know. I mean, I have to re-question it now. You know, maybe it was more me than her. I mean, we were definitely Catholic. You know, we went to church. And, you know, the Catholic doctrine isn't the most open.
Right.
Warhol was Catholic, too. So many of his superstars were. But I, at home, I definitely, like, as I write in the rape book, you know, thinking I was pregnant by the dog. And at 8... thinking, you know, about potentially killing myself.
Right.
Because I thought I was pregnant by the dog.
And,
I mean, where does that come from?
It's just, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And TV, and I guess, you know, things I must have heard my parents say.
Yeah, just confusion. We've got to wind down here, and I just do want to ask you what are you writing now, Fiona?
Well, I just started to mention it. I never graduated college. I did a few semesters of community college in New York City and just blew it. You know, I wanted to go out and be a crazy person. But I started taking a class. Ultimately, it's a certificate course. It's a library science thing. But I'm taking a class in children's literature, so I've had to read all these children's books.
Oh, wow.
Which, I read kids' books to my son. And my mother always read us, like, Shel Silverstein and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm reading current children's books, and they're great. I mean, I feel like there's this whole genre of literature that I totally ignored, and so many of them are just, you know, so sly and so funny and subversive. John Classen is somebody, I don't know if you've ever read any of his books, We Found a Hat, Where's My Hat? He's great. So then I had read this legend about Katharine Hepburn, and I love old Hollywood. I had read this legend about Katharine Hepburn and Howard Hughes, and they did go out, and she used to live in the town that I live in.
Yeah.
The town that I live in is very, even though she's been dead, I don't know, 20 years, we still very much venerate her here. She's a draw to this area.
Yeah, I can imagine.
That Howard had bought her this clock. And it was this golden clock with a green pendulum. And during the hurricane of 1938, the clock was lost. Her family's house was destroyed. And so I got this idea for a children's book about Catherine and Howard and the clock and buying her this clock and, you know, the hurricane. And, you know, and the last lines are like, you know, Catherine lived in the house that her family rebuilt after the hurricane for the rest of her life. You know, and sometimes she would look out on Long Island Sound, and she thought she saw a twinkling of the clock.
Because right.
It was, you know, lost, you know, after the hurricane, either on Long Island Sound or some people think it was buried under the house. So I have the fantasy of this being a children's book. I mean, we'll see. I can't draw.
Usually...
So I'm all over the place. I'm branching out all over the place. I'm also working on an essay about Casey Anthony, so...
Oh, wow. Okay.
Another example of... continuing the theme of my book, I thought something then, I was wrong. You know, let's figure out why I was wrong. Yeah.
I don't think children's writers usually do illustrate their own books, so I was just going to say
that.
I
know, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't. I really know nothing about the process of getting something like that published either.
Okay. All right. I just have one last question for you, Fiona, and that is, I usually like to end, because a lot of my listeners are writers, so I like to end asking my guest for advice for writers, and I was wondering if you could offer advice for writing about topics that maybe shame or embarrass oneself, because I've read things that you've said about this, and I thought that would be a nice way to finish.
I would write it without thinking of the audience in mind.
Yeah.
Just write it as a purge, if anything. get it down, and then afterward go back and figure out maybe what's too much for you, or you know, figure out what is, you know, just going too far when it comes to revelation. Even I look back now at some of the things that I write, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that I was that that I was that candid.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's different for me because I still write for the small presses, so there still is that degree of, you know, privacy, in essence. The audience isn't big. I read Roxane Gay's book, Hunger.
Yeah, I did too. Isn't it wonderful?
It is. It was absolutely great. But I think even if you don't end up showing it to anyone, that it's still worth it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what my advice would be, but besides to just do it, you know, go for it. And remember, you don't have to show it to anyone.
Right, right. That's great. That's great advice. Okay, I want to mention again that the name of your book is Girls Gone Old, Essays by Fiona Helmsley, and it's published by We Heard You Like Books out of Los Angeles. So thank you, Fiona, for speaking with me today. It was great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author, Fiona Helmsley. You can learn more information about her work at her website, fionahelmsley.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about something you're ashamed of or not proud of. You don't have to show it to anyone, just write. Write on paper with a pen and pencil. If you don't trust doing it on your computer, tell yourself you can destroy it after if you feel the need. See what happens. Maybe being honest about your shameful moment will help you push past something. Or maybe you'll decide it wasn't so shameful after all and you can shape it into something you might be proud of. So good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion.
One of the features that I aired on the show this week was a conversation with Claire Benedict about books that she's read lately that she has particularly enjoyed. Claire is the co-owner with her husband Rob of the Bear Pond Bookstore in Montpelier. I'm just going to read over some descriptions of the four books that she mentioned. And if you're interested in hearing my full conversation with Claire, that's available on the podcast site. The first was The Heart's Invisible Furies by John Boyne, which is published by Hogarth. Cyril Avery is not a real Avery, or at least that's what his adoptive parents tell him, and he never will be. But if he isn't a real Avery, then who is he? Born out of wedlock to a teenage girl, cast out from her rural Irish community and adopted by a well-to-do if eccentric Dublin couple via the intervention of a hunchbacked redemptorist nun, Cyril is adrift in the world, anchored only tenuously by his heartfelt friendship with the infinitely more glamorous and dangerous Julian Woodbead. At the mercy of fortune and coincidence, he will spend a lifetime coming to know himself and where he came from, and over his many years will struggle to discover an identity, a home, a country, and much more. The second book Claire mentioned was Landscape with Invisible Hand by M.T. Anderson, published by Candlewick. When the VUV first landed, it came as a surprise to aspiring artist Adam and the rest of planet Earth, but not necessarily an unwelcome one. Can it really be called an invasion when the VUV generously offered free advanced technology and cures for every illness imaginable? As it turns out, yes. With his parents' jobs replaced by alien tech and no money for food, clean water, or the VUV's miraculous medicine, Adam and his girlfriend Chloe have to get creative to survive. And since the VUV crave anything they deem classic Earth culture, doo-wop music, still-life paintings of fruit, true love, recording 1950s-style dates for the VUV to watch in a pay-per-minute format seems like a brilliant idea. But it's hard for Adam and Chloe to sell true love when they hate each other more with every passing episode. Soon enough, Adam must decide how far he's willing to go and what he's willing to sacrifice to give the VUV what they want. The third book Claire mentioned was Wonder Valley by Ivy Pechoda, published by Echo. From the acclaimed author of Visitation Street, a visionary portrait of contemporary Los Angeles in all its facets, from the Mojave Desert to the Pacific, from the 110 to Skid Row. During a typically crowded morning commute, a naked runner is dodging between the stalled cars. The strange sight makes the local news and captures the imaginations of a stunning cast of misfits and lost souls. There's Ren, just out of juvie, who travels to L.A. in search of his mother. There's Owen and James, teenage twins who live in a desert commune, where their father, a self-proclaimed healer, holds a powerful sway over his disciples. There's Britt, who shows up at the commune, harboring a dark secret. There's Tony, a bored and unhappy lawyer, who is inspired by the runner. And there's Blake, a drifter hiding in the desert, doing his best to fight off his most violent instincts. Their lives will all intertwine and come crashing together in a shocking way, one that could only happen in this enchanting, dangerous city. And the final book that she mentioned in our conversation this week is Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng, published by Penguin. In Shaker Heights, a placid, progressive suburb of Cleveland, everything is planned, from the layout of the winding roads to the colors of the houses to the successful lives its residents will go on to lead. And no one embodies this spirit more than Elena Richardson, whose guiding principle is playing by the rules. Enter Mia Warren, an enigmatic artist and single mother who arrives in this idyllic bubble with her teenage daughter Pearl and rents a house from the Richardsons. Soon, Mia and Pearl become more than tenants. All four Richardson children are drawn to the mother-daughter pair. But Mia carries with her a mysterious past and a disregard for the status quo that threatens to upend this carefully ordered community. When old family friends of the Richardsons attempt to adopt a Chinese-American baby, a custody battle erupts that dramatically divides the town. I'll leave it there. Those are the four books Claire recommends. I can agree with her on The Heart's Invisible Furies, which I'm reading now and really enjoying. If you want to hear my full conversation with Claire Benedict, you can go to the podcast site.
Next week on Write the Book, I'll offer two new interviews. The first is with Catherine Patterson, whose new novel for young readers is My Brigadista Year, which follows a young Cuban teenager as she volunteers for Fidel Castro's National Literacy Campaign and travels into the impoverished countryside to teach others how to read. The second interview will be with American writer Grant Faulkner, who is executive director of National Novel Writing Month. NaNoWriMo, as it's known, is coming up before we know it, when a lot of people across the globe, I believe, will attempt to write a novel in a single month. Are you planning to write a novel next month? If so, you may enjoy this interview with Grant, whose new book is Pep Talks for Writers, 52 Insights and Actions to Boost Your Creative Mojo. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show, news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you have been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.